Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome into Mining Stock Daily and our long form episode for the week. This is Trevor Hall. What an incredible week. Nice to see precious metals and the rest of the metals complex continue to move up. We are going to talk about all of those things, including inflation and also a general sense of where we are in the major markets. Two guests today. We start things off with Jesse Felder from the Felder Report, having a nice long conversation about a range of topics with him. And then we turn it over to Rob Sin, CEO Technician, once again, welcoming him back to the show with a lot of his thesis and analysis of where we are in the markets. We cover a lot of different topics. There is something for everybody in this episode. Special thank you to our sponsors, Integra Resources, Western Copper and Gold, Corvus Gold, and Rio 2. We appreciate your continued support of the podcast and allowing us to put the content out every day during trading hours. Special thanks to Kylie Williams for also helping us out here from time to time, doing the morning briefing and also a few interviews. You will be hearing more from her. She's really smart people, so pay attention, watch her. All right, we are going to jump to the conversation with Jesse. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for your emails. Thank you for the thumbs up and the reviews and all that stuff. You make it worth it every day. Have a great, wonderful weekend. Be well. I usually spend a few moments giving brief introductions, but Jesse Felder, you've been on the show enough. I don't think we need, grand pomp and circumstance introduction because we have quite a bit to talk about. There's this quote that you wrote in your blog post on thefelderreport.com the other day, and you said, "Congrats, Jay. You've officially blown the biggest stock market bubble in history." So let's start there, Jesse.
Yeah.
Let's start with your general sense of where we are with the general big board equities and the markets here. It's a little bit of exhaustion, it feels like.
Yeah. I think what maybe some people don't appreciate is when you look at the Buffett yardstick, it's just the total value of the stock market, all equities, the market cap of all equities compared to the total size of the economy. We're now 40% higher than we were at the peak of the dot-com mania. So what that means is, stocks would need to fall 30% essentially overnight in order to match the peak price from the top of the, what's considered the greatest bubble in modern history, the dot-com bubble. That's how far we've now gotten. It's so far beyond anything we've ever seen before. And there's all kinds of other measures I could go into, but like the median stock price today, the median, stock in the S&P 500 is almost twice as expensive as it was 20 years ago at the peak of the dot-com mania. So not only is it just the total stock market is more overvalued dramatically, it's the average stock is. So it's a much broader bubble than this one was 20 years ago, which was really just focused in tech and some blue chips. But very similar to what we saw kind of into the fall of 2000. So March of 2000, the dot-coms, the NASDAQ peaked, rolled over, sold off pretty hard. In those first few months, actually the New York Stock Exchange composite went on to make a new high, I think, in September of that year, but the NASDAQ never came close. And that was a sign of just increasing dispersion within the markets. And I think we've seen the S&P, continue to push higher to new highs over the last few months. But the Russell 2000, and more importantly, a lot of these real speculative names, have not come close to making new highs. You look at basically anything in Cathie Wood's portfolio, the ARK Innovation Fund, and on average, a lot of the stocks in that portfolio are down 30% plus. I mean, I think you have Zoom, Peloton, Roku. A lot of these stocks are down more than have lost more than half their value. Not to mention, what a lot of these SPACs are doing. You know, whether it's Virgin Galactic or, you know, any of these other down, you know, 70-80% off their highs already. To me, it's a sign of increasing risk aversion in the stock market, which is really an early sign, of an impending bear market.
Okay, risk aversion. That's something that we have not been called out here, you know, just blatantly on the podcast. So, you know, let's kind of keep that theme here. And I do want to go back to really, you mentioned the Buffett yardstick, but you also talk, you know, something very similar would in the move in the chart would be the Fed balance sheet here. Interesting, push and pulls here between Fed Chair Jerome Powell last week just standing firm that they're not going to consider tapering, more of the same. But then you fast forward a week later, and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen comes out and mentions, maybe carelessly, maybe not, maybe it was choreographed, I don't know, there might be a need to increase rates. Is that maybe kind of a sign that there's a little bit more concern behind the curtains here of people running this economy than the market had maybe given them credit for?
Well, I think there has to be a great deal of concern among the Fed. They can't really talk about it. I think the extent of, you know, what they're willing to say is, you know, we saw Jay Powell last week's, you know, call the markets frothy. And, you know, he's not going to just throw out a term like that. That is going to be something that, you know, he considered saying and, you know, made the decision to, you know, you can't really consider it kind of a warning shot, you know, across the bow of the markets, because everything else he's saying is so incredibly dovish, you know, talking about we're not even close to talking about raising rates, right? I mean, I think the markets are pricing in the first rate hike by the end of next year, but, you know, Fed's not talking about, you know, maybe raising rates until 2023 or something. And they're not even talking about tapering asset purchases yet. And they've said that they'd probably start tapering those before they even consider raising interest rates. And so, you know, I think they have a major quandary on their hands right now, because they understand that, you know, unprecedented, you know, valuations in the market, the bubbles, you know, that we're seeing in the stock market, in, you know, cryptocurrencies and real estate, all these things are just exploding higher altogether, really start creating, financial stability concerns for the economy. And so, you know, that's a problem. And so they really want to kind of continue stimulating the economy, but they understand they can't do that without, you know, encouraging people to take on more and more risk. And so, you know, they're really kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. And it's really kind of, you know, something of their own doing, obviously, you know, back to the Bernanke days where he said we're consciously going to implement quantitative easing in order to try and create a wealth effect. You know, in not so many words, he's saying we're going to support asset prices to try and make people feel richer, to support the economy. And, you know, once you open that Pandora's box, you can't ever really afford to let asset prices fall, because then you get a reverse wealth effect, which, you know, it works, downward on the economy and has negative effects on the economy. So I think that, you know, this is a quandary. It's a, you know, catch 22 of their own making. And it's going to come to a head here sooner rather than later, I think.
Well, it's compared to what the dot-com bubble was, you know, back in 2000, 2001. This bubble is not just tech stocks. It's almost across the board and in many aspects. I don't know, Jesse. I'm just kind of curious. Is there an opportunity at all to slowly deflate this bubble, or is it more likely or not that something could be a catalyst to really have a really hard and sudden drop?
Well, I think we're already seeing that in a lot of these. So just look at the 1 year history of unprofitable, you know, tech stocks. I can't remember who it was. Somebody pointed out on Twitter this week, you know, the ARK's performance, ARKK, Cathie Wood's ETF, is almost identical to that of just unprofitable tech firms, you know, almost like Exactly. And, you know, those things have just screamed higher and, you know, completely unsustainably. And now they're reversing lower. And, you know, so I think we're already seeing that. But what I'm more concerned with is that we're inflation's already here. We're seeing inflation like we haven't seen in years and years, if not decades and generations, really. And so at some point, the Fed is going to be forced to turn their attention to reining in inflation and maybe more importantly, reining in inflation expectations, which are potentially being stoked right now. And when they do that, you know, like we saw with Janet Yellen just suggesting rates might need to go up at some point in the next few years, the market kind of freaks out. Because right now the stock market is extrapolating 0% interest rates and $120 billion of asset purchases essentially indefinitely into the future. And so as soon as that forecast changes, that we're not going to have 0% rates, now we're going to have asset purchases to, you know, support markets, you know, we're going to have another tantrum. There's going to be another taper tantrum. And if the Fed, you know, is finally forced to fight inflation, it's going to be much more than a tantrum. You know, if we have to have, if short-term rates have to go to 2-3%, you know, that's enough to, I think, crash the markets at this point.
Where does yield curve control sit in all of this here, Jesse? Your thoughts on yield curve, because that's been an idea and a conversation. You know, we haven't had a lot of it the last, I would say, month or at least a few, couple weeks when say things like the 10-year treasury were really moving up. Is that still a possibility in your mind, or are we along the lines of literally just having to just raise rates?
Well, I think yield curve, you know, this is part of the dilemma facing the Fed is, you know, they may be forced to fight inflation. But, you know, like this is, you know, we're entering new territory where I believe we already, dating back to the end of 2019, we already saw the beginnings of fiscal dominance, where essentially the Trump tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, forced the Treasury to start selling much more debt than the market could bear. And so repo markets kind of essentially went haywire in the fall of 2019. And the Fed had to step in essentially, you know, I mean, we could go into detail about that, but essentially there wasn't enough demand, natural demand for treasuries beyond the super leveraged basis trade where hedge funds buy a bunch of treasury bills and fund it in the repo market. When they couldn't get that repo funding anymore, that, you know, there wasn't enough demand for treasuries and potentially interest rates on treasury bills could have screamed higher just like repo. And, you know, that could have caused major problems, right? I mean, when the government gets to a point where the debt is so big that rates can go up enough to make the government essentially insolvent. And by insolvent, I'm not saying obviously insolvent like a company. I'm just saying that blatantly to a point where, you know, the monetary authorities have to directly fund the government through money printing, which we're not quite there yet, but we're very close. You know, that's the point at which the Fed has to implement yield curve control. They can't fight inflation. And, you know, I believe we've already started MMT, and what MMT says has to happen at that point is taxes have to go up in order to fight inflation. So you raise capital gains taxes, income taxes, all these things to kind of slow the economy from overheating. And maybe that's the way they fight inflation. Either way, it's going to have, you know, major ramifications for the markets.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned modern monetary theory, because if you have at all been a student of that practice, or, you know, theory, however you want to put it, something like that capital gains tax raise proposal shouldn't come as some surprise, as, you know, arguably as egregious as it might be in size. But, you know, with the amount of money that's been flushed into the system, they have to find a way to balance that out. And that's usually through taxation.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're already seeing. I mean, the monetary authorities are already telling us, and the fiscal authorities, the Biden administration, are already telling us they've already bought into this whole MMT framework. The Fed would love to just keep short-term interest rates at zero and, you know, and pin the yield curve, you know, where it is today with 30-year yields at 2.25% and, you know, all the way down to zero at the short end. And just let, you know, the fiscal authorities, you know, be in charge of reining in inflation. That is essentially the definition of fiscal dominance. Fiscal dominance essentially meaning when a government becomes so indebted, it can no longer afford for monetary policy to fight inflation or do whatever it needs to do from a policy standpoint, is completely beholden to funding the government. And I think that's potentially where we are. I mean, I don't know exactly where we are in that stage, but I think we've already kind of crossed the Rubicon into fiscal dominance. And so I think that's why we're seeing, you know, the administration and even Janet Yellen saying, yes, we need to raise taxes in order to kind of lay the groundwork for, you know, if inflation comes up. You know, Yellen saying, you know, rates might have to go up a little bit, but I think she's also saying, and Joe Biden is saying, and you know, that taxation is probably the preferred method for fighting inflation going forward.
Yeah, we've mentioned inflation quite a bit, Jesse, but when you talk about an individual investor kind of putting inflation in the forefront when it comes to preparing or setting up their investment portfolio, and while continuing to be risk averse, how do you set up your own personal investment portfolio with inflation knocking at the doors as we've seen the last couple of months?
Well, there's really, I mean, two keys. Limit your exposure to financial assets to whatever is tolerable. So that's limit your exposure to both equities and bonds. You know, because financial assets typically do poorly with rising inflation, and increase your exposure to real assets, you know, mainly precious metals, commodities, and real estate. Now, residential real estate might not be the way to do that, but with its current valuations. But you know, I think the last time we talked, I mentioned I've been getting much more bullish on gold over the last couple months again, because I find it terrifically ironic that, you know, just as the fundamental case for gold is getting stronger and stronger and improving from a macro standpoint, you know, in terms of, you know, like these fiscal and monetary policies that we're talking about, but also from just an economic standpoint too, where, you know, rates, you know, have looked like they've peaked and have started rolling over. At the same time, inflation is just going to start to take off in the headline numbers. That to me is hugely bullish for the gold price. And at the same time, we've seen sentiment turn dramatically against the precious metals. I mean, the ETF outflows are, you know, it's over the last 6 months, it's more dramatic than anything we've seen since this new gold bull market began back in 2015-16. And so, you know, people are literally just throwing in the towel, giving up on gold right at the wrong time.
Well, it's funny you actually mentioned the yellow metal, because we are recording this Thursday afternoon, about an hour before the market close. Gold's having a great day, up 1.5% or almost $30 on its price, $18.15, give or take. Really solid move here. Do you feel like a move like this above that $1,800 level might change that sentiment and see more buyers come in?
Absolutely. Like my friend Helene Meisler likes to say, there's nothing like price to change sentiment. And so, yeah, improving price is going to change sentiment. And I think, you know, there's potentially some downtrend resistance right around 1855. But if we break out above that, gold, to me, the short term, you know, I mentioned real rates, and essentially I look at the 30-year yield less core CPI. And so 30-year yield's roughly 2.25 today. If CPI, core CPI, goes to 2.25 over the next, you know, couple of months, that's 0% real yield on the 30-year yield, you know, if the yields don't go up again. To me, that means gold should be breaking out to new highs. Gold's going over 2,000 an ounce pretty quickly. So, you know, that's the setup over the next few months. Now, to the extent that, you know, rates start going back up in to keep up with inflation, that forecast may, you know, be a little bit more conservative. But I do think it's very likely we see new highs in the gold price before year end.
Bold statement. I like it. I have said on the show that I think the case for gold continues to be bullish. My fear is that we get a big moon shoot like we did last summer, into August, where it comes back and corrects pretty hard for either, you know, a hard short period of time or just a really long grind lower like we saw for the 9 months correction here. I mean, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the time of this is if we do reach those all-time highs once again. I don't know. That's not really a question, Jesse. More or less an idea for a conversation. I mean, talking about timing to reach those all-time highs, but you're saying it might be expedited, quite like it was last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great point that you make about that blow off last year, because sentiment got way too overextended. People got way too bullish towards, you know, the precious metals last summer. And that's just, I think to me, that's one of the most important things I look at for gold. I mean, sentiment is always important in looking at any asset class that, you know, I look for to buy things that are hated, and I look to kind of avoid or reduce exposure to things that are become overloved. And, you know, we saw that last summer with gold got extremely overloved for a period of time. But, you know, just like in the last few weeks, maybe a month ago, I saw two more, articles come out saying, you know, from major publications, both Bloomberg, you know, top Bloomberg opinion writers. And these are exactly the types of signals I look for, which is, you know, I think it was Joe Weisenthal wrote a piece about how, you know, gold macroeconomics has failed. And, there is no worth to gold. And he kind of trotted out the same Jason Zweig, thesis that gold is a pet rock. Jason Zweig, you know, famously called it a pet. And I love Jason's work, but and Joe's too. But media reflects mood, and so when mood gets so strong, the hate gets so strong towards gold that you see, these prominent writers, you know, suggest that gold is worthless. To me, that is just a terrific buy signal. And that's what we saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago, which is why, you know, in addition to these fundamental factors, you know, I literally came to the conclusion a few weeks ago, I can't own enough gold right now.
Well, how else are you playing? Are you playing the miners, the producers? Are you starting to look at the explorers at all? I mean, I know you're pretty conservative, you know, when you do take positions, but, you know, it's got to be more than just the metal itself.
You know, I usually, for my core position, I like to use the Sprott Physical Gold and Silver Trust. It used to be the Central Fund of Canada. The thing, you know, will at times trade at a 5-6% discount to its underlying, you know, net asset value. So I don't know of any other way to be able to buy, you know, physical metal for 5 or 6% below market. But this ETF regularly gives you regularly gives you the chance to do that if you own enough of it too. Sprott will convert your shares into bullion. So there's really no risk of owning, you know, paper gold. But I like that it has a, you know, significant allocation to silver too, because silver is obviously, you know, a higher beta of the two. So, you know, like we're seeing now when gold goes higher, you know, silver tends to scream higher, and silver is cheap relative to gold. But yeah, there's some miners too that I I use for more of a trading standpoint. And there I'll, you know, with all of my other traditional kind of equity analysis, I'll look at, you know, things, what's kind of cheaper within the group. I kind of have a handful of names that I like that I keep track of. And, you know, where's their, you know, insider buying? And there was some major insider buying over the last few months in Barrick. And so that's been my primary focus is Barrick through this cycle.
Yeah, Barrick's up close to 6% today, Thursday afternoon, off of this big run in gold. Their peers Newmont up 3%, and some of the smaller producers, you know, Equinox Gold, they're up 5%. I mean, obviously big moves. I mean, and we've mentioned it time and time again that the financials quarter over quarter just continue to improve based on the gold price, but we're still not necessarily seeing a lot of that big, smart institutional money from Wall Street or, say, the West Coast starting to come in. Do you feel like this year that will change?
I really do. I think, you know, a lot of people look at, most people look at the gold stocks, and they probably should, the miners as cyclicals. And so with any type of cyclical stock, you know, it typically looks cheap at the highs and looks expensive at the lows because the earnings are so cyclical. And so when things are going great and earnings are awesome, investors aren't really willing to pay a higher multiple because they know that, you know, through, as we, you know, progress through the cycle, earnings are going to come back down. And so that's potentially not sustainable. I think, you know, to me, the best example of that right now might be a lot of these mortgage companies that have benefited from, you know, massive refinances, right? We saw record low interest rates over the last year. And so everybody who's ever wanted to refinance their house has been able to and has done it. And so some of these companies trade at 3x earnings. I mean, like they look incredibly cheap, but that's because people know if interest rates go back up, refinancings are going to drive. I mean, literally those earnings are going to go to zero, right? Nobody's going to be refinancing anymore. So investors are smart to be only willing to pay 3x earnings for these stocks right now. The difference with the gold miners is that if it proves that their current earnings are not top of cycle, but are sustainable and probably moving higher, then investors will be willing to put a much higher multiple on a lot of these names. And that's just incredibly bullish. Like I said, if the gold price moves to new highs, you know, that's what, like a 20% move, something like that on the gold price. It's going to be 200, 300% move in a lot of these miners because people are going to realize, wow, the earnings look high now, but they haven't even begun to, you know, explode higher if gold prices are moving that much higher.
I think I'm going to go buy more calls on Barrick here, Jesse. you know, let's move over to the commodities trade here. And I know if I called gold a commodity, I'd have a lot of diehard listeners out there reach through their Wi-Fi and then the iPhone and want to strangle me. So let's call it the commodities trade. Anything from the base metals complex to agriculture, continue the inflation trade continues to move. It's been really just kind of a driver behind all this. How are you looking at this at the commodities complex now? Is it early stages? Are you waiting for some sort of pullback? Or where is the opportunity here, Jesse?
Yeah, I think, you know, markets discount, you know, about 18 months into the future. You know, that's not my thesis. That's, you know, I got that from Stan Druckenmiller. And so I think if you're, whatever you're trading, you know, you got to consider these prices are going to be moving today based on, you know, what's going to happen a year and a half from now. And so I think probably, you know, commodities are probably short term overbought. I mean, you know, things like lumber have just gone crazy. Copper prices too. You know, last summer I wrote a piece basically comparing gold to the commodities index and suggesting that, you know, commodity space was incredibly cheap relative to the gold price and that, you know, commodities had to scream higher. And that's still the case. So I do think longer term, we're in just in the early innings of a new, you know, major bull market for commodities. But in the short run, I think 18 months from now, economically speaking, we might be, you know, seeing, you know, a significant slowdown. I guarantee you we're going to see a significant economic slowdown from the explosive growth we're going to see over the next couple of quarters. So it really depends on how much that slowdown is going to, you know, happen. And, you know, I think that's what probably the commodities markets will have to start, you know, for discounting is we're going to see a slowdown in economic activity. We're going to see a lot of these supply chain disruptions and things, you know, worked out. And we're going to, you know, sentiment again towards commodities right now has gone a little bit crazy. I think, you know, we're seeing 90% plus, you know, bulls and DSI readings and, you know, all kinds of commodities, which is typically a sign that they're, you know, they've gotten overextended. So, but then again, you know, just from a momentum standpoint, I hesitate here because when you see as the types of strong momentum we're seeing in a lot of these things, that's not a sign of typically of a permanent top. That's a sign that this uptrend is in, you know, its middle stages Or maybe early stages, rather than its late stages. That's one of the things I look for is just momentum. And I think we'll see, on the longer term charts, weekly, monthly kind of stuff, you'll start to see that momentum waning, even with much higher prices probably than we see today, before you see a major top in these things. So, yes, I think short term, we might see some trading tops and a little bit more congestion, going forward over the next few months. But longer term, I think it's just a very bullish setup for most of them.
It is an interesting relationship to see, really 10 to 12 years of just bearish sentiment towards commodities. And all of a sudden you get this huge breadth of momentum upward on almost an exponential move in a lot of these things in the last couple of weeks of, last couple of months. So it's hard to judge that midterm range here with this commodity sector, just looking back at 10 years and just how bad it was for all those physical assets.
Yeah. Well, that's I wish I could, attribute the quote to somebody, but it's, the remedy for, high prices is high prices, and the remedy for low prices is low prices. And the way that works is, when you have high prices in any kind of commodity industry, it attracts a ton of capital. So much capital goes in, you get overproduction, which, leads to oversupply and falling prices. And so we had such a long, long period of low prices for commodities and underinvestment that it just sets the stage for this, for a major bull market. I think oil probably is the best example, where we saw in the wake of the financial crisis, cheap money allowed a lot of these fracking companies to go spend like crazy, building out new shale wells. And so we had a huge boom in oil production in the United States. Well, what did that lead to? A huge crash in the oil price of 2014 and several crashes since then, when oil prices eventually went negative last year. So, but since then, over the last several years, really since 2015, 16, 5 years, we've had very little capital. The energy industry has been starved for capital. And so, this is one of the reasons why I was just pounding the table bullish on energy last fall, was because so little capital has gone in that it necessitates higher prices. There's been so little investment in a lot of these wells, and these wells have been depleted a lot faster than anybody expected. So, just that fundamental backdrop is very, very bullish. And so, I think you can kind of extend that to the broader, commodity sector, is that financial assets have been the king of the hill for 10 plus years, and commodities have been kind of left for dead, and capital has followed, and that sets the stage that starving the commodity sector of capital for that long just sets the stage for the types of shortages and stuff we're seeing now, which is very bullish.
Yeah. Jesse, one last question for you. We usually get a chance to catch up with you, every 1 or 2 months, give or take. Since we'll let you go, let's say we catch up with you later in June. What is something, if you could pick one thing out of these markets you're really paying attention to, what would that be right now?
Since I think it was my first market comment of 2020, early January 2020, I said, from here on out, and this is in the wake of the repo fiasco that I mentioned earlier, the number one chart to watch is the dollar, because the Fed is being forced into, this is not quantitative easing like we saw in the wake of the financial crisis, which was designed to support markets. The Fed is now being forced to monetize the debt. And at some point, people are going to realize this. And I think it's, that's what's behind the crypto craze right now, is people realize the Fed is being forced to monetize the debt. They're not doing this monetary policy from a discretionary, standpoint. They're doing it because they have to. There's just not the natural demand for it. And so when there's the broader recognition of that dynamic occurs, you're going to see it play out in the dollar. So if the dollar breaks down, the really important lows in the dollar we saw in the beginning of this year, there's that horizontal support that dates back, several years. So a breakdown below that line to new lows, 52-week lows in the dollar, would be, you know, a very, very important development. So that's really what I'm watching most closely.
Jesse, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I hope you have a wonderful spring. We look forward to catching up with you as we approach the summer, if not into the summer. A lot of great content here, and we always really appreciate your time.
Yeah, sounds great.
Miss Jesse Felder from The Felder Report. Go check out his blog. He's got a lot of content out there. He's also got his own newsletter, thefelderreport.com. Great stuff, always providing us here on Mining Stock Daily. Everybody, we're going to take a real short break, and then we'll be back with the second segment of the show. Hey, we're back here with another segment of our long-form Friday interview here on the Mining Stock Daily podcast. Happy to welcome in once again the CEO technician himself, Mr. Rob Sin, joining us from Florida. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe he just liquidated his Dogecoin and his Cum Rocket tokens. So to tell us all about the gains he just made in the crypto space, Rob Sin, how are you, my friend?
Good to hear from you, Trevor. Man, I wish that I had more, or I had any Cum Rocket coin, or I had any Dogecoin left, but unfortunately, I guess I'm not smart enough to those trades.
That whole narrative is just mind-boggling, and I know that the crypto space, the hodlers, really put Warren Buffett's feet to the fire based on his comments last week during the Berkshire meeting regarding his own thoughts on cryptos having little to zero value. But, you know, hodlers typically do that. They get so defensive. It's like the Tesla stock owners, right? They get so defensive over the stock. They see it going to the moon. But I tend to agree, like, there is no value to a lot of these crypto coins or whatever that are just created out of thin air. There's no use for them. What's the use case?
Well, I mean, with Dogecoin, it has all the functionality of any other, crypto. So you can transfer coins through, encrypted code on a blockchain very quickly for relatively low cost. So it has the functionality. And it kind of proves that if enough people adopt something as valuable, then it's valuable. So it's proving that. And the fact that it was invented as a joke is sort of having fun, these guys, in 2013, which is at this point, like ancient history. It's kind of funny and cool that it's become this big theme of 2021. And, you know, you have Elon Musk and all these famous people talking about it and buying it and sort of pumping it. And I think with the Warren Buffett thing, like, my take on it is, first of all, you know, we talk a lot about bias in the junior mining sector. We talk about, you know, oh, do you own the stock? Are you talking your book? Blah, 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 right? And I think the Warren Buffett comments prove that everyone is biased, whether or not they have a direct financial incentive or not. Everybody has bias that they bring to the conversation and to markets and to stocks. And Warren Buffett's bias is, hey, I completely missed this trade. I have no Bitcoin and I missed this trade. And now I need to talk bad about it, because I know eventually this market is going to have a very sharp drop. I don't know when or from what valuation that's going to occur, but it's not in my interest to advocate it now, because my company doesn't have any exposure to it. I don't have any exposure to it, and I'm super late to the party. And also he sees that there are some very dangerous speculative elements to this space, as we're seeing with like Cum Rocket Coin and Scam Coin and Titcoin and whatever coin you want to make and then pay people and models to flash their breasts, you know, to get people to buy some. There's a huge speculative element to it, and there's a Ponzi element to it, a very big Ponzi element to it. And so he sees that. So, you know, in one sense, he's talking his book, and he's talking bad. We see this in junior mining all the time, where certain sector commentators don't have any exposure to a company that's had a big move, and then they try to poke holes into it and say how it's not a good stock or there's something wrong with the projects, right? So Warren Buffett is no different here. He's talking down a big trade that he missed.
We've all missed a trade, but you know, I think you and I have had the same conversation. Just because you missed one trade doesn't mean you're going to miss the next big one, right? I mean, there's always going to be a trade in the future. There's always going to be an opportunity somewhere else.
That's for sure. I mean, that's for sure. And with Warren Buffett, I mean, geez, he's got so many irons in the fire and so many trades.
Yeah. In your trading lab, you had written this: when all one needs it to do in order to get rich is create a new crypto with a catchy name, hire a bunch of models and influencers to promote it, well, you got to wonder how sustainable this shit is. But the bubble hasn't popped yet, Rob. As concerned as people are, this bubble continues to inflate.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, first of all, I want to say that I express my opinion strongly at times. But I also want to be humble and say that my analysis is far from perfect. I'm not a sage that can see the future. And markets can do crazy things for very long periods of time. So while I am in the last few days striking a note of caution, especially about this Ponzi element, this speculative mania that we're seeing in certain aspects, like with Dogecoin, I also, you know, could be on the sidelines for a long time as it goes higher, you know, and I'm not short any, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum or Dogecoin or Cum Rocket. I wouldn't even know how to short Cum Rocket. I'd have to, you know, figure it out. I don't even know if it's possible. So I have no like dog in this fight aside from being a market observer for half my life and a trader and a, you know, investor. So I've seen when markets get very frothy and excessive. And so you point out my morning email, and this is not 2008. It's not going to be exactly like the global financial crisis. And maybe we're not even going to have a crisis for a while. But if I think back to 2008 and I think back to all the mortgage fraud that started to become known, you know, it was uncovered in 2007 and 2008, all these fraudulent, you know, mortgage documents that people use to get money to speculate in the housing market, right? And then what the investment banks did to repackage them and sell them to investors. And then we look at, you know, Bernie Madoff was uncovered at the end of 2008. And those are just a couple of examples. There's many more. Fraud, the cockroaches started to come out from the crawl space in 2007 and 2008. And then confidence was shaken and lost, right? And then we had the financial crisis. And so I think Felder's blog post that I shared this morning about the boom in fraud is very timely, very timely. And you go through it, and there's so many examples of fraud and Ponzi schemes that have come about in the last 6 months. And when you contrast that with the obvious signs of greed and a mania in certain pockets of markets, you know, there's clear signs of huge excess out there. And, you know, this ties into what Janet Yellen said yesterday, and I think that this ties into what we wanted to discuss too. It's clear that Biden and his financial policy heads, like, you know, Yellen, are going to target the rich and try to cool some of the more speculative pockets of markets through taxation in the IRS. And if we think about the gains that have occurred in things like Ethereum and Dogecoin, et cetera, in the last year, there's a lot of big capital gains, a lot of big profits out there, and maybe even some people that are thinking they're going to outsmart the IRS. And I think they're going to have a come to Jesus moment at some point in the next year or so. And you know, the Fed has to thread this needle between trying to support the underlying real economy and create full employment while not generating massive speculative bubbles, which are sure to pop. It's just a matter of when. And when they pop, they have all these unintended consequences, all these side effects that hurt the real economy. And I think that's the really tricky situation that the Fed, the Treasury, the policymakers have right now.
Mm-hmm. That whole conversation around raising taxes on capital gains, I mean, maybe you and I can spend a little bit of time discussing this, because I have been working on this idea in the back of my mind as it pertains to modern monetary theory. And those people who are, you know, diehard MMTers, if that's what you can call them, will go back and say taxing and increasing taxes is a way to kind of put a check in the amount of liquidity and overall money that has been flushed into the system. And so to see the amount of, you know, the trillions of dollars that has been flushed into the system, and having this idea of what modern monetary theory is and how it is practiced, I don't necessarily think we at all should be surprised by the amount of increased taxes that the administration has proposed. And I don't think it's going to be the last. But at the same time, on that level, I don't think I would have a hard time seeing a double in capital gains taxes. I do see an increase happening, but I don't know if a double. That just seems like meat on the platter for the, over, you know, the very progressive tax the rich type of policymakers. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be a double, but it's definitely going up, and it's going up, you know, enough that it matters. And I think that they will target the tax hikes and new tax policies to target some of these more speculative aspects of financial markets, because you still want people to invest in the stock market. The stock market is an overall major net positive for the economy and for the country and for the world, right? You know, capital formation is critical to progress, right? And so long-term capital gains, maybe they'll bump them up a little bit, but they do not want to, you know, hinder people's, you know, willingness to invest their savings, their, you know, 401ks, et cetera, in the stock market long term. But I believe that some of these really, you know, excessive pockets, you know, that's the term I've been using, because there's quite a few of them. Pockets of financial markets that are showing a high greed, high degree of, you know, mania right now is an enemy to long-term progress and to the stabilization of the economy, right? Because these things are unsustainable. Like, yeah, I'm sure Dogecoin's going to be here for the rest of my life in some way, shape, or form. But a 70x move in a couple of months is unsustainable, right? So, and you also, a lot of people that are speculating in these markets do not even have basic understanding of market cap and how many coins are in supply and how many can exist in the future, and these basic things. Instead, they're just citing, well, it's 50 cents, so it's really cheap, right? Well, as you know, in junior mining, if there's a billion shares out and it's 50 cents, well, it might not actually be that cheap, right?
Mm-hmm. On the back of that, you know, Rob, this is really interesting, and I think it's worthy of a little bit of debate as well, is if maybe the reason for this tax hike on capital gains is because of these speculative investments into something like cryptocurrencies, which can have an argument of have little to zero actual value. They're just created out of thin air and hit to the market and obviously seeing just outsized gains. You do not have to be an accredited investor to buy these cryptos. And so, but you do have to be in many ways an accredited investor to say, purchase, you know, going on a private placement financing for a junior company, or maybe it's not even a junior mining company. Maybe it's a software engineering firm with a good idea that's trying to get venture capital, or biotech type of, you know, research type of business. You know, and those types of companies rely on investment from people to put their money into those businesses and help them grow, help them succeed. That's the idea of putting it to work. Now, if you are scared of the cryptocurrency binge and gains and want to tax that, wouldn't it be tangible to say that the negative effects would be, well, you're also be taking away from the potential growth of these new real businesses and ideas that really provide progress and ways of how we will be doing things in the future?
I think you said it perfectly. I don't have anything to add to that. That's on the money. And I think that with stuff like the stock market and private placements and small companies, there's so many barriers to an investor even being involved in participating at all. Way more barriers than there is to buying Dogecoin or Cum Rocket, right? And it's these barriers that in some sense keep small investors safe in theory from scams, quote unquote, right? But look at what's happening right now with all these coins. And I think, so this is going to be, there's going to be massive paradigm shift in regulation because it's just, well, it's not safe for a lot of people to be speculating like crazy in a lot of these things. And this is such a fertile soil for fraudsters. I mean, it makes junior mining look like a bastion of virtue, as funny as that is to say, right? But there's barriers in junior mining. There's regulations that don't exist for Cum Rocket coin, for scam coin, right? And so I think we're going to see a lot of regulation. It's going to be part of the evolution of the space. And government wants their piece of the pie. And that's the way it's always been, all the way back to the times of kings and queens, where they would say, well, you made 100, you know, gold coins. I want 50 of them, you know. And it's still, yeah, I want 50 of them just because you're part of my kingdom. And I say it, and if you don't agree, you know, you're going to hang. And in some way, shape, or form, that still exists today with the IRS. If you don't pay your taxes, you go to prison, right? And a government wants their piece of the pie, and they're going to get it, and they can track all your crypto. They know where all of it is. Even if you think you're so clever, you've got it hidden, you're going to avoid taxes, they know
Trust me, they know.
Yeah. Yeah. We should probably talk about the metals industry here, Junior Miners. That good conversation. I mean, we could talk about that. You and I could sit around, you know, the bar and over a beer and have a real long conversation about all this. And hopefully we will be able to do that someday soon here, my
friend. Yes, sir.
I do want to fall back. You mentioned Janet Yellen a few minutes ago. She really put the markets in turmoil on Tuesday. It was interesting. You know, I was actually pleasantly surprised seeing gold get a bid early in the morning after the COMEX open, because that has rarely happened anymore. It was moving up nicely, and then all of a sudden, 2 hours into trading, Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary, comes out and says they may need to increase rates to fight an overheated economy. That put everything in turmoil, including the major markets and precious metals. It seemed a little bit off cuff and maybe dangerous for her to say, because she's no longer the Fed chair. She's sitting in another seat. But, you know, watching the activity in the markets after that happened, Rob, I just want to get your thoughts here and really like the how this did make you change your thesis at all in the midterm.
No, I don't think so. I think that she has to say, you know, policymakers have to at least be on record saying, hey, cool it a little bit. But it's like a parent telling their kid to not try to, you know, leap off the bed or something. You know, it's like they're going to do it anyway until something happens, until they bump their head on the wall or stub their toe, and then there's crying, and then you have to, you know, take care of them, you know, and, you know, maybe even, you know, lock them in their room for an hour to calm down or something, right? And I think that's what these policymakers, Powell and, you know, Yellen are doing. They're doing a little tango, a little dance with the market, but the market knows that the Fed's mandate is very clear: full employment, stable inflation at 2%. And so many Fed speakers are on record saying it's okay if inflation overshoots to 3% in the short term, because the structural headwinds are so strong, we don't think it's going to stay up in a dangerously high level, right? And if it does, we have the tools to take it back down, which obviously they do. They could hike rates and they could sell off their balance sheet and just kill everything, right? But this is what I said, by threading a needle, this is a very delicate surgery, monetary policy surgery, that policymakers are trying to orchestrate here. And it's, in some sense, it's like trying to like get the first down on 4th and 30. It's like a lot can go wrong, and you've got to throw that ball just perfect, and the receiver's got it. You got to catch him just in stride, you know. I think there's a lot that could go wrong here. And I'm an inflation skeptic, but I'm not a skeptic in that the Fed's probably not going to land this plane exactly right. It's going to be a bumpy ride, and there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences. And I don't know what they're all going to be, but I think that policymakers do need to talk down some of these pockets of major excess, because the bigger they get, the more parabolic these charts go, the more novice investors that get sucked into frauds and Ponzi schemes and pump and dumps, the worse it will be in the future. You know, it's like we're pulling forward all these gains, and then what do we have? At some point, you're at the top of the mountain. There's nowhere to go but down. And, you know, there's that chart, that market cycles chart, and the top one, you know, my favorite one, says it's a new paradigm. So you know you're at the top when everybody's saying it's a new paradigm and it's different this time. And you look at the charts and they're all parabolic, they're all up huge, and everybody's shouting, it's different, it's different, I need to get in. And then you know there's nowhere to go but down.
Yeah. So you remain an inflation skeptic?
I mean, I'm not an idiot, Trevor. Obviously, I realize that prices have been going up since the pandemic, right? I get that. I mean, I see it in my Uber rides in South Florida. They've doubled since last June. the cost. I see the price of gasoline has gone up. I see the copper chart, obviously. But what I'm saying is a long-term inflation skeptic. We have an aging population. People are having fewer and fewer kids. We are in a massive global debt bubble. Debt is deflationary. It is, you know, inherently a headwind to progress and growth. And there's more debt in the world today than there's ever been by many multiples, right? And so you add up all of these structural factors that aren't going anywhere. And it's hard for me to think that we're going to have high growth and too high inflation for years to come. We are in a sugar buzz period with a lot of, supply chain issues due to the pandemic that has caused things like lumber to go parabolic, et cetera, et cetera. Clearly, there are structural, factors in stuff like copper and tin, which aren't going anywhere anytime soon. And I think that those kinds of metals could actually go up to a price so high that just like there's no bids, you know, like suddenly it's just like, wow, we've gotten so high that, hey, or I'm not buying copper at $7, you know? But in the short term, we're in a sugar buzz. We are in a Fed-fueled speculative frenzy in a lot of financial markets and various asset classes. But longer term, the challenges that the global economy and the economies of countries in, you know, Europe and the U.S. face are massive. And that is the key underpinning to why I'm a gold and silver bull. I'm not a gold and silver bull because I'm bullish on inflation in the short term. I'm a gold and silver bull because I'm skeptical of long-term economic growth and all the things the Fed's going to have to do and do wrong to try and keep the can being kicked down the road.
I will give you a counter argument. The deflation stance I can understand and definitely respect. But you did mention the there's a decreasing population here in the States, but at the same time, we also have a very much increasing amount of dollars being created. And I think that's a counter argument to the inflation side that I see.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, if the Fed continues to expand its balance sheet at 30% a year, we're going to have a lot of inflation, Trevor. I just don't think that they will and they can. And you know what? If they do, then I'm wrong on being an inflation skeptic, but I don't give a shit because I've got a lot of gold and silver and mining stocks.
Right. Your portfolio is set up for that.
Right.
So, yeah. Okay. Well, let's do talk about, I want to talk about gold here real quick and then talk about some of the junior stories you're following. Gold continues to get hard rejection up at that $1,800 level here, Rob. A couple days tried to get up there, but just push back down once it hit like $1,799. That obviously is the next key level of resistance here we need to bust through. Do you think a third time's a charm to get up to that level and pass through it?
My fingers are crossed, Trevor. I say odds favor yes, like 70-30. I think we can probably get through it in the next few weeks. But I do think it's tough sledding. Like, it's not going to be like we're going to 2000 in 2 months, you know, like last summer. I think that we're in a range here, you know, where there will be times where gold will drop $50 or $100 over a couple of weeks based upon, you know, people thinking the Fed's going to tighten sooner or some stuff like that. Or we might go to 1850. In the next few weeks as people think, oh, the Fed's on hold for a really long time and inflation is not as big of an issue as we thought, right? So there's going to be this data, jobs data, inflation data, all this data that's going to be this ping pong ball. There's no clear trend in gold. It's just sort of in a range bound day-to-day gyration. But like I've said for the last month, I think we've seen the bottom. Could we go back down to 1700? Sure. But I think 1670 is a pretty solid floor that's in place now.
Well, even if it does call it a consolidation here, the upper levels around, you know, between 1760 and 1790, I mean, that could provide a pretty good support level going forward. I mean, think about it, just a couple of weeks or months of being around this range, and then you get into the fall. I mean, that's a pretty bullish case for the metal technically.
Yeah, and I feel like a broken record. I'm not even going to say it, but yeah, I agree with everything you said. Yeah, this is a good place for gold to have negative sentiment and be out of favor.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, enough said about that. Let's talk about some of the junior equities in mining and mineral exploration. Some pretty important stories out there that have hit the tape in the last couple of weeks. Rob, you know, you look at a lot of stories, you write about a lot of companies. What are maybe one or two of the more important stories that or developments that you have been following lately?
Oh, there's so many, but I'm just going to keep it simple. I think that we're entering the summer months and money flies north for the summer, generally in the junior mining sector. So let's go to the Yukon. And there's no shortage of really high quality companies up there that are going to be doing big drill programs, or they're already doing a big program like Banyan Gold. We've discussed that a couple times in the past. That company continues to put out good news. And I think they're going to have a lot more positive news over the coming months and actually through the rest of the year. Fireweed Zinc raised money at market, hard money financing with one investor, $5 million at market price, which is not something that we see very often in the sector. So, you know, hats off to Fireweed. They're going to, I think, have a super aggressive summer program at Mac Pass. And White Gold. So I'll just add a third one. White Gold, I think that stock is so cheap, you know, massive property package in the best claims, the best properties in the territory. And I just think it's we're overdue for a really good summer from those guys up there. And there's a lot of really high quality exploration stories. And I just named three of them. Just off the top of my head, because I like all those management teams and I like those companies, but there's a lot more too. So I think it's a seasonal time. It's early May. Let's buy some of those far north stories.
Now take us back to the Yukon. That was a great trip.
Yeah, and I can't wait to go back there, but I don't think they're going to let us in, you know, this year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say. Rob, this was a great conversation. We covered so much ground, but we needed to because it's been a little bit since we've had you on the show. You and I can always dive into so many different topics and be honest and candid with each other, and I appreciate you. Trust your insights, and man, just a real pleasure to always have you on.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invite, and yeah, it was a great conversation. Thanks, Trevor.
Thank you, Rob. Rob Sin, CEO Technician. That's a wrap here this week on Mining Stock Daily. We will be back Monday morning with the news briefing. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody. Stay safe, stay healthy, be well. Oh, yeah. Give your mother a hug and a kiss if you can. Tell her you love her. Happy Mother's Day, moms. The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decision.